Bristol, Vermont, WNYV, Whitehall, Glens Falls. It's 8 o'clock.
Good morning. This is Northern Light for Monday, March 18th. I'm Monica Sandresky.
And I'm Todd Moe.
Coming up, a conversation with St. Lawrence County DA about the St. Lawrence County DA about his investigations into dozens of abuse claims against the former Ivy Ridge boarding school in Ogdensburg. School is the subject of a new Netflix documentary.
We can't base our cases off of what was on Netflix. When it comes to what we need to do, we need these individuals to come forward, tell us what happened to them. We've got to look at those cases on an individual basis.
We're starting a three-part series on prisons in the North Country. Today, a look at the shortage of corrections officers. The state is now planning to close up to five more prisons. In the meantime, programs for inmates are scaling back and COs are overworked.
Why can't we hire more COs? Is it because no one wants to come to work there because it's not safe?
No, I don't believe that that's the issue. I mean, I think that we have a national shortage of correction officers and in law enforcement in general, so we're all fighting over the same candidates.
And for generations, camping has been a big part of life in the Southern Adirondacks. We'll check in with the curator of a new photo exhibit of family lean-tos and small cabins in Glens Falls. All that's coming up in Northern Light. Stick with us.
Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by Adirondack Experience, the museum on Blue Mountain Lake, presenting their new Eclipse Experience Zoom series on select dates in March and April. Details at theadkx.org. And by Apothecary Chocolates, making gourmet chocolates by hand from all-natural herbs, botanicals, and tree syrups, apothecarychocolates.com.
This is Northern Light. I'm Monica Sandresky.
And I'm Todd Moe. The St. Lawrence County District Attorney's Office is sorting through dozens of accusations of physical and sexual abuse against the former Ivy Ridge boarding school in Ogdensburg. The State Attorney General's Office has also opened an investigation. Investigators are combing the school site for evidence. District Attorney Gary Pasqua is imploring the public to stay away.
Documents that are still there, documents we may need down the line for further prosecutions. So, you know, individuals who go there because they're curious or interested, you know, that's just going to interfere with our investigation.
All the interest and so many former students coming forward is because of one of Netflix's top news shows, a documentary called The Program. Former students describe being separated from their families and thrown into a cult-like military-style environment where they were allegedly subjected to numerous abuses. More than 7 million people have streamed the documentary since its release earlier this month. DA Pasqua told David Summerstein it's given former students the courage to report their experiences to his office.
For whatever reason, maybe believing that, you know, if they had come forward, that people wouldn't have believed them because of the situation they were in. Now seeing that someone has stepped up and done this documentary and that there are people behind them that do believe in them, that is giving them the strength to come forward and let people know what happened. And hopefully we will be able to do something for them. We don't know if we're going to be able to at this point, but we're certainly here to listen, to take those reports, and we will vet them and see if there is something that we can do for them.
As you go vetting those cases, how do you vet what was in the documentary that sort of triggered these cases? How do you know that, you know, what is in the program is true?
We're not really concerned necessarily with what was in that documentary specifically, right? We can't base our cases or what we do off of what was on Netflix. That certainly was the catalyst for these individuals to come forward. And what was in that documentary was concerning. I mean, there are videos there that clearly are very concerning when it comes to physical abuse and things like that. But when it comes to what we need to do, we need these individuals individuals to come forward, tell us what happened to them. We've got to look at those cases on an individual basis, see what we can corroborate about those individuals being at Ivy Ridge, first and foremost, because we want to make sure they are and were actual students, and then see if those are cases that we can actually prosecute.
Have you been in touch with the filmmakers about any evidence or documents they may have?
I'm just not going to comment on that at this point, because I just don't want to discuss, you know, who exactly has come forward and who may have made or not made allegations.
What about the statute of limitations regarding these cases and the Adult Survivors Act, I suppose? Can these cases be taken forward?
It depends. You know, those like the Adult Survivors Act and things like that, a lot of that dealt with the civil aspect of things, not necessarily the criminal aspect. So a lot of it depends on what the allegations are. No matter what, I'm not going to specifically speak to any certain set rigid statute of limitations regarding anything until anybody who wants to come forward has, and we've had the ability to speak to them about their individual case.
What about the people who worked at Ivy Ridge? Some of them still live in the area. There are reports out there that some may work at the psychiatric center in Ogdensburg or other places. What are your concerns about that?
Well, I think the one thing to remember is, you know, looking at the documentary, you know, anytime you see a documentary like that and you see the videos and it's going to raise concerns, it's going to raise feelings in the people who watch it, and a visceral feeling about wanting to protect children and hold those people accountable. I think what's important to remember is the majority of the people who watched that documentary weren't there. They do not know the whole story. Obviously, the individuals who made that film, students who were there, they know what their experiences were, okay? And they know the people that they may have interacted with, okay? But what I think needs to be stressed is the simple fact that an individual worked at Ivy Ridge does not necessarily mean that they are guilty of a crime. It does not mean that they abused someone. Going out and harassing an individual or harassing a business or making threats to a business or an individual simply because they're mentioned in the documentary, that's not good for anyone. That's not good for the person making those threats, because all you're doing is you're committing a crime yourself. That is not going to help the individuals who may have been abused. That is not getting justice for them. That's not going to help our investigation. Let the process play out. Let us do our job. Let law enforcement do the investigation. If we can prosecute somebody for the crimes that occurred, that will happen. But going out and harassing individuals because of some place that they worked, when you don't know how long they worked there, did they know these things were going on? Did they see any of these things? You know, that's not justice. That is not being fair to individuals who may have had nothing to do with the events that you saw in the documentary.
Gary Pasqua is the district attorney for St. Lawrence County. He spoke with David Summerstein about the investigation into physical and sexual abuse claims at the former Ivy Ridge boarding school in Ogdensburg. It's the subject of a new Netflix documentary called The Program.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. It's 9 minutes past eight. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll check out the current exhibit on display at the Chapman Museum in Glens Falls, Adirondack Cabins and Camps. That's coming up in just a few minutes here on Northern Light.
Cloudy skies and scattered snow showers, sleet in the forecast today, highs in the 30s. near 40, and winds out of the west southwest 10 to 15 miles per hour. Scattered snow showers again tomorrow, about a 30% chance of scattered snow showers, and a high around 30 on Tuesday. Right now in Canton, 30 and snow showers. Music by Gretchen Kohler on fiddle, Daniel Kelly on piano. Northern Light is supported by the Village Mercantile in Saranac Lake, established in 2011 with a mission of community-fueled solutions. With products for home, camp, and gift-giving, villagemerc.com, anything but general.
More than 5,000 people work in prisons in the North Country. For decades, these have been some of the most sought-after jobs, offering good pay and long-term benefits. But the prison landscape in New York is changing. Fewer people are incarcerated, facilities are closing, and the job market isn't what it used to be. Prisons are now struggling to attract workers, and the state wants to close more facilities because of staffing shortages. Emily Russell reports.
Talk to any correction officer, and they'll tell you they've got a tough job. Working in prisons can be dangerous, it can be depressing, but lately it's been even more demanding.
They're overworked, they're burnt out, they're working doubles, they're giving up time with families.
That's Daniel Marticello. He's the head of New York's Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. Marticello testified in Albany back in January. He told lawmakers that there were thousands of job vacancies in New York prisons, putting a real strain on the system.
That keeps me awake at night, and knowing that that's the impact and they don't have that work-life balance is troubling to me.
There are staff shortages of cooks, of plumbers, of teachers, and healthcare workers in prisons. About half of the 3,800 job vacancies are for correction officers. That overall lack of staff means a lack of programs, things like college classes and vocational training for people in prison. That's what's happening at Greenhaven Prison in the Hudson Valley.
They don't have enough staff to, for example, keep the program building open.
That's Jennifer Scaife. She's the executive director of the Correctional Association of New York, a kind of watchdog for state prisons. She says programming is crucial. It gives people in prison more purpose. It teaches them new skills. Scaife's team visited Greenhaven Prison back in November. They found the program building at the prison was really impacted by the staff shortage.
It was closed 7 days out of 10 for the months leading up to our visit last fall.
So what's happening here? What's causing this staff shortage among prison workers here in New York? Some union leaders and lawmakers point to the dangers of the job. Assaults on state prison staff are up by 40% in the last 5 years, though 97% of those incidents don't result in any injuries. Back in January, State Senator Dan Steck, who represents the North Country, asked Commissioner Marticello about the impact of those assaults.
Why can't we hire more COs? Is it because no one wants to come to work there because it's not safe?
No, I don't believe that that's the issue. I mean, I think that we have a national shortage of correction officers and in law enforcement in general. So we're all fighting over the same candidates.
To attract new candidates, the state has set up recruiting centers and malls. They've posted signs along busy roads. But the problem goes beyond just recruitment. The state is also struggling to retain workers. John Roberts is a vice president for NYSCOBA, a union that represents correction officers.
We've seen people leaving with 15, 18 years, 10 years, just quitting and not worrying about their pension, which is an alarming thing because these jobs used to be sought after. State jobs used to be a very positive thing.
Roberts worked at Clinton Correctional in Dannemora. He says being a CO is not a fun job. But if you work for 25 years, you can get a good pension for the rest of your life. Many retired COs collect anywhere from $40,000 to $80,000 a year. But Robert says that's just not enough to entice people anymore. He thinks the state should pay COs more and offer even better pensions. Roberts also says closing prisons sends a bad message to a future workforce. New York has shuttered 24 facilities since 2011. A third of those prison closures have been in the North Country.
Younger kids see that, or their parents work there in some fashion, or their family, and saw that it closed. And they're like, well, are we next? Because every year, you know, it's the same thing every year or two. You're seeing these places close and people are just looking at other avenues now.
This year, Governor Kathy Hochul wants to close up to 5 more prisons. That's part of her proposed budget, suggesting the closures could save the state $77 million a year. No one would be laid off, but Hochul says she's aware of the impact this could have.
I know this is frightening. These correction officers are some of the, you know, the hardest working, underappreciated people in our state system, and I do appreciate them. The work they do is incredibly challenging.
But the reality is the state's prison population has plummeted. It's down 55% since the late 1990s. Even after 24 prisons have closed, there are still thousands of empty beds, plenty of space to consolidate inmates into fewer prisons. The governor's proposed budget includes up to $500 million to repurpose former state facilities. Assemblyman Matt Simpson says that's a good investment since there are 7 empty prisons in the North Country. He's critical of the governor's plan, though, since she's proposing only giving prisons 90 days' notice ahead of a closure. Previously, facilities got a full year's notice.
To do this in 90 days, to talk about closing 5 facilities, not announcing which facilities are being eyed, creates a lot of fear in a system that's already rampant with, you know, concerns for safety.
Simpson and other North Country lawmakers are urging the governor not to close any of the 11 state prisons in the region. The state assembly removed the proposal from the budget they've put forward amid negotiations with the governor and the state senate. Meanwhile, many advocates say the focus on prison staff levels is misguided. Benjamin Heller works for the Vera Institute of Justice.
Instead of using our large prisons to prop up this whole industry so people have jobs, why not find people jobs that don't come at the expense of the liberty and well-being of people who are caught up in the system?
Heller says the goal for lawmakers should be on decarceration, on putting more money towards preventative measures for New Yorkers.
We should be thinking about providing stable housing and mental health treatment and substance use treatment and well-paid jobs to people before they end up involved in our system and end up in prison.
Heller authored a report a few years ago about the price of the prison system in New York. It found that each person held behind bars costs taxpayers $115,000 a year. The Department of Corrections and Community Supervision has a budget of $3.4 billion this year, a large portion of which pays for staffing. Emily Russell, North Country Public Radio.
Another Democratic challenger has joined the 21st Congressional District race to take on Representative Elise Stefanik. Scott Philip Lewis announced his candidacy last Thursday in front of the Olympic Center in Lake Placid. As the Adirondack Daily Enterprise reports, Lewis has lived in Saranac Lake since 2021 and says he worked previously as a stock trader. He spoke about immigration, health care, and how the real battle in America is not between political parties, but rich versus poor. He also addressed a DWI charge in Texas from 2019, saying he's been sober for the last 3 years. Lewis is the third Democrat to join the field, joining Steve Holden and Paula Collins. Jill Lochner will challenge Stefanik for the Republican nomination, and Brian Rouleau is running under the Working Families party line.
For over a year now, both Jefferson and Lewis counties have lacked a medical examiner. That means there's no one to perform autopsies. Bodies are sent to either Binghamton or Syracuse, which is costly. Lewis County's manager, Ryan Peach, told WNY-TV that Lewis County wants to share a medical examiner with Jefferson County, which they've done in the past.
When we had the relationship right here with Jefferson County, we only spent about $12,000 on transportation. This year, we had budgeted $60,000.
The lack of a medical examiner has led to further hurt for grieving families, according to Richie Turk. His wife died in February, and he told Lewis County legislators at a public meeting recently that his wife's body was still in Binghamton at the time of her funeral.
She was not there for her funeral, for her family. And over 500 people that came to the church to see her.
Piche says the medical examiner's position in Jefferson and Lewis counties is vacant because there's a nationwide shortage of medical examiners and forensic pathologists.
A Rochester-based developer is taking a second crack at state funding to transform a large vacant building in Watertown into moderate-income housing. The former Black River Paper Company building sits on Factory Square in downtown Watertown. Last year, Greenleaf Community Builders out of Rochester unsuccessfully applied for a $10 million Restore New York grant to convert it into 105 apartments. The Watertown Daily Times reports that officials from Greenleaf attended a recent city council meeting. They said they'll reapply for $5 million this year for a scaled-back version of the project. The city council agreed to formally support the apartments with a letter of intent to the state.
And the town of Canton has adopted a new zoning law that allows animal shelters, including a controversial dog shelter just outside the village. No Dogs Left Behind rescues dogs from dangerous situations around the world, including in Ukraine, Afghanistan, and China. Its founder, Jeff Berry, opened his first U.S. shelter in March on State Route 68. But the previous town code didn't permit animal shelters. It only mentioned kennels and animal hospitals. Some of the shelter's neighbors filed noise complaints and raised concerns about waste disposal. They also pointed out at town board meetings that the shelter was operating against code. But the new code will allow for such shelters. Berry also won a noise complaint trial last month.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. In just a minute, the small camps and lean-tos that make for family camping in the southern Adirondacks. There's a new exhibit on display in Glens Falls. Then stick around after the show for Bird Note just ahead at 8:42. But first, Todd has a look at the weather for us.
Highs today in the upper 30s, near 40, with scattered snow or sleet, west winds, west-southwest winds, 10 to 15 miles per hour. And that's pretty much the forecast for the week. It's going to be cooler this week and feel more like winter than the start of spring tomorrow. Isolated snow showers, highs in the 30s, and chance of a wintry mix again Wednesday and Thursday. Highs Wednesday near 40, highs Thursday in the 20s near 30. Right now in Canton, we have snow showers and 30 degrees.
Camping is a big part of summer life in the southern Adirondacks. Photographer Seneca Ray Stoddard captured hundreds of images of family camps and lean-tos between 1875 and 1890 in the area. And I recently caught up with Maureen Folk. She's the curator at the Chapman Museum, who put together an exhibit in Glens Falls of his photographs called Adirondack Camps and Cabins.
A large portion of them just happened to be around Racket Lake. He was certainly exploring that area during that time, and it features small, like lean-to type cabins. We have one or two photos of more of like the camp setup, and then we've got photos of like Great Camp Pine Knots. And so it gives a broad range. There's one that's Camp Echo. That's a beautiful photo. And then we have some nighttime scenes. So Stoddard was experimenting with nighttime photography, and one of his most famous images is like the Statue of Liberty that he took at night, but he was still testing that out in the Adirondacks at nighttime. So we've got some scenes of people around a campfire or sitting on the porch of a great camp, and he's lit up that nighttime scene using a magnesium mix to create that flash. So it features some of those images as well.
Were there one or two images that stood out to you or that you were particularly drawn to?
There's a nighttime scene that I do particularly like. You can see like the campfire on the left side of the photo, and then the right side of the photo is probably a dozen to 20 people, you know, gathered by this porch. They're obviously out, you know, enjoying the nighttime, enjoying the campfire, enjoying the the space and just the quiet of the Adirondacks at night. I love that one just because it's such a great, well-composed photo. And then I think the other one that I really love is the one of Camp Echo, just because it's that classic Adirondack rustic style, especially on the outside. The handrails on the porch are like branches and twigs from trees, and they used some of the branches to spell out Echo as part of the porch railing. So it's just a really, really beautiful camp.
Who was Seneca Ray Stoddard?
So he was quite a prolific photographer in this area and in this region. At the time, he was a luminist photographer, and he really experimented with new techniques and things like that. He lived and worked in out of Glens Falls. He actually, his house would have been about two blocks away from where the museum is now. But he really traveled the Adirondacks, and he traveled internationally and nationally as well. But his real body of work is in the Adirondacks. And he took pictures of the landscape. He took pictures of the impact of industry, the impact of tourism. He really captured all sorts of different things at a time when people, you know, portrait photography was really how you made a living in photography at that time when he started. And he really branched out and started to take landscape photos. And that's how he decided to make his living.
And as you're putting up the exhibit, what kinds of things were you thinking about?
I think for this one, I think the photos just capture the sense that I think the Adirondacks tend to give people. You want to be one with the great outdoors, right? You go to these areas that are heavily wooded, beautiful lakes and scenery. And I think Stoddard really captured that well. And so I think these photos are just of the time so much in how people were starting to settle into the Adirondacks and try to make it an escape for themselves or a home away from home. And I think that those photos really capture that.
Maureen Folk is curator of the Chapman Museum in Glens Falls. The exhibit, Adirondack Camps and Cabins, is on display through April 2nd.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Monica Sandreski here with Todd Moe. In these last couple of minutes on the show, we're going to go out on a little bit of music. This is a new single from the group Cassador from Kingston, Ontario. This indie trio just played in Ottawa over the weekend, and tonight they're headed to the Casa del Popolo in Montreal. This is their new single, Squeeze.
Down. I cut the brakes at the top of the hill. I'm just out of town. And when the lightning strikes, I'll be there in the rain. You can hold my hand as we.
That's the song Squeeze by the group Cassador from Kingston, Ontario. Again, they just played Ottawa over the weekend, and they're headed tonight to the Casa del Popolo in Montreal. You can find out more from that venue's website. That's it for the show for the day. I'm Monica Sandreski.
I'm Todd Mello. Thanks for listening. Be well.
I do it all for you. I do it all.